Shrink Wrap Radio number 357, Lifelong Love, with Phyllis Koch-Sherris and Peter Sherris.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guests today are husband and wife team, Dr. Phyllis Koch-Sherris and Peter Sherris, and we'll be discussing their work on lifelong love. The authors have been working with couples together since the mid-1970s and have been training other therapists for 35 years. They have been married for nearly three decades and have two adult children. Dr. Sherris and Koch-Sherris are featured regularly on the radio and live in Charlottesville, Virginia. Peter L. Sherris, Ph.D., ABPP, is a clinical psychologist and a professor in the University of Virginia's Curry Programs in Clinical and School Psychology. He has been in part-time independent practice for nearly 30 years and has authored publications on couples, parenting, youth violence, and adolescent development, including Your Child, Bully or Victim, Understanding and Ending Schoolyard Tyranny, and Clinical Psychology, A Social Psychological Approach. He holds a diplomate in clinical psychology, is a past fellow of the American Academy of Clinical Sexologists, and past president of the Virginia Psychological Association. He appears frequently as an expert in the media on topics of couples, adolescents, and families. He received his doctorate from Princeton University. Phyllis R. Koch-Sherris, Ph.D., is a practicing clinical psychologist and co-author of several books on dreams and couples, including the Dream Sharing Source Book. She is past president of the Virginia Applied Psychology Academy and the Virginia Psychological Association. She received her doctorate from the University of Texas and has worked in state hospitals, university counseling centers, and independent practice. She was previously the director of training for the University of Virginia Counseling Center. Dr. Koch-Sherris is a Bon Buddhist practitioner. Now, here's the interview. Drs. Phyllis Koch-Sherris and Peter Sherris, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, you're a couple of psychologists and a psychologist couple.
Yes, yeah.
Yep. So how did you get interested in working with other couples?
Well, we actually met on our internship at the VA hospital in Palo Alto, and we were fortunate enough to be able to work on the family study unit with some of the people that were really on the cutting edge of working with families and couples. And it was so exciting and so rewarding that we kind of continued to do it in our careers for over, like, I guess that was almost 40 years ago.
We actually had back-to-back rotations. So Phyllis was first, and she saw some couples and treated them, and then she transferred all those cases to me.
No, only the one that I didn't cure.
Well, the one, yes, the one that you didn't cure. Which,
oh, we have a couple fight already.
Which I, of course, did cure. But,
oh, did you? Okay.
So we had an opportunity to interact, but we also were, you know, together in this interns group. So that's, you know, our relationship sort of sprung from our, you know, being together in a variety of different case conferences, a variety of different settings. So that was really how we got to know each other.
I'm trying to think of some of the names that might have been associated at that time with that center. Virginia Satir comes to mind.
Yes, Virginia Satir, yes, and mm-hmm. Watzlawick, Weakland. And
yes.
The people at the Mental Research Institute were affiliated, and then also just some folks who worked on the family study unit at that VA medical center.
Yeah, those are all very familiar names to me.
Or Yalom, and yeah, a variety of different people.
Oh, Yalom was there too.
He actually ran the growth group for our interns group.
Yeah, we had a collaboration with Stanford University.
Yeah, yeah. So You two fell in love about 35 or 40 years ago. What can you tell us about the beginning of your love story? You just mentioned where it happened, but give us a little bit of the flavor of that.
We've written in our book, Lifelong Love, about our two versions of, of the
There's always
love.
Two versions.
My version is that the first day of the internship, when we sat down at this long table, the person that was sitting across from me was Peter, and we talk about something in family therapy called the laying on of eyes. And as soon as I laid my eyes on him, I was like, oh, I think this is going to be a good internship.
Great.
And we actually didn't have our first date until the intern Christmas party, because I was playing the field a little first, and I think Peter was as well. But we just were very drawn to each other.
Yeah, Peter, what's your version of that story?
My version was it was not love at first sight for me, that in the kind of swirl of events, I noticed Phyllis kind of attracting a lot of attention, and sort of my style was to back away from that. Mm-hmm. So I really got to know her and her work as time went on. In the beginning, I think I remember what she was wearing that day, and you know, that she was physically attracted, but, you know, I was too scared about everything else going on in my life at that point.
I can identify with that.
To be paying much attention. It took till the 7th of December, which is Pearl Harbor Day, which was the day of the intern's Christmas party, that we actually sort of had our first date. We came separately and left together from the intern's Christmas party.
And since that date, Peter has remembered the anniversary of our first date every year, and I've remembered it about half the time.
Okay. Pearl Harbor Day, though, that doesn't sound terribly auspicious.
Ah, yes. Well, it helped me remember. It was also a significant day in the life of my family, so it was easier for me to remember.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, in your book, you point out that falling in love is easy, and I will attest to that. The hard part is making love last. Why is that such a challenge?
A variety of challenges for that, keeping relationships going. One is the culture in which we live, and we talk a lot about the cultural variables of sort of individualism and individual achievement and, you know, being rugged and independent. And there are also a lot of other factors, like we don't have a history now. We're in generations where half of our parents were from divorced households. And there are a lot of temptations in the immediate. There's a lot of things like laws that discriminate against actually being married for people who are in love. So there's always, it seems like there are lots of ways out of relationships. One of the things that we talk about in the books that we write is that it's not that relationships are bad, or even going badly. It's just that people give up a lot earlier than we would like them to.
So that the whole notion of commitment to someone and something becomes too scary, I think, for a lot of people to be willing to take on. And there's always going to be ups and downs in a relationship. And if you're not willing to commit through the hard times, then, as Peter said, the easier way out is to just end it. And with so many people in their families and their friends are all around them divorcing, there's more of a culture of divorce than there is of commitment. I just saw a couple yesterday where the young man said he really wants to work on their relationship, but that he cannot see committing to a marriage or lifelong relationship, because with his parents and everyone in his family, all he saw was hardship and agony over relationships and divorce. So, you know, right now, I think we're in a culture where it's even more difficult.
Yeah, you know, and something you said, Phyllis, made me think of the fact that young people these days aren't dating. They don't use the word dating. They don't say, you want to go on a date, as we did in times mm-hmm. past. What I've heard from students is hooking up.
Yeah, that they hook up.
Yeah, that they hook up, which...
Well, even without that, it's unusual in this case, but this woman didn't believe in having sex before marriage. But even with that, the notion of committing seems to be the hardest thing for people to get past.
Yeah.
So if we can make commitment, not something like you think of where you're going to be committed to an institution, you know.
Right.
I think it was H.L. Mencken said, love is a wonderful institution, but who wants to live in an institution?
Right. Now, there's scads of books out there giving marital advice and advice on relationships, and yet you say they fall short. How so, and what? Why?
All of these books that we've seen talk about committing to the other person, and that's all based on the individualistic philosophy and culture. And that's going to break down at some point because people change. And if you're just committing to a person, then that's a kind of shaky ground.
And you're always looking for, how are they doing? How am I doing? What should I be doing? What shouldn't I be doing?
So what's different about our work and our books is we talk about committing to the relationship and committing to a vision for the relationship that you both are a stand for, that you both commit to. And from there, then you take everything on as a team, everything. So even if the individual has a project, like we worked with a couple where she had a dissertation to complete, the couple took it on, and they created a way to work on it that she felt supported, and he was able to get support for the work he was doing at the same time.
One of the problems, Dave, for people getting into relationships is that they're constantly concerned about what they're going to have to give up. Am I going to have to give up autonomy? Am I going to have to give up my hobbies? Am I going to have to give up my free time? Rather than seeing that a relationship isn't necessarily an obligation, but it's an oasis. It's actually an opportunity to have help and support for what you want as an individual. As long as there's some agreement, the relationship becomes like your child. What's in the best interest of the relationship? And love comes from that, and everyone's individual needs get met through the power of the relationship.
And most of the books about relationships focus on what's wrong and how to fix it. And that's not what we're about. We're talking about a designer marriage that you get to create and have a positive vision that you come from that allows you to stay on course without having to fix something that's wrong, but keep your eye on the prize.
Yeah, you're kind of reframing it. And I realized when that term came to mind that comes out of that Palo Alto group.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it does.
And you're kind of reframing it in a more positive way and kind of going against the tide of individualism that you spoke about before. And you actually have, I guess, coined a term, couple-ism.
Yes, because we don't have a language even for how couple can be in the world and have a powerful relationship. So we're like having to make up this new language. Individualism is all over the place. But what about couple-ism?
Mm-hmm. Most people think of a couple as two people. We think of couple as one couple. We had a conversation with a friend of ours once who was a member of Congress, and we sort of jokingly said that we were thinking of running for Congress as a couple. And he said, oh, that would be great. You could share the work. It's a lot of work. You could each do half. And we said, no, that wasn't what we were talking about. We were thinking, what would it be like if we took on legislation looking through the eyes of a couple? What would it be like if the Middle East negotiators brought their spouses to the negotiation? What would it be like if we looked through the eyes of families and relationships and what we're trying to accomplish?
You know, I seem to recall that, and I don't know if this is just me and I'm projecting, but I seem to recall that there was a little bit of a negative connotation with couples that were sort of too tight and had lost their individualism. You know what I'm getting at?
Yes, sure. And, you know, there has to be space within the couple, in the entity, for both people to thrive as the individuals that they are. And what the kind of couple-ism that we're talking about supports the individual through the couple, so that you actually have couple as a source for enriching the individual. There's many accomplishments that I have had. I have an art exhibit up now in a restaurant in Charlottesville that wouldn't be up there if I didn't have couple to support me hanging that exhibit. So, you know, Peter doesn't do art, but he gives me the space to manifest that as an individual by his supporting me.
Uh-huh, yeah. You call your approach couple power. and you've been teaching this approach to countless numbers of couples over a period of years. Why do you call it couple power?
We call it couple power because we see as an approach to empower the couple so that it's actually getting something out of the way, spending less time worried about what's wrong and more time thinking about what's possible as a relationship. And there are a couple of components. One is just when you operate as a team, sometimes the sum is greater than the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put two people together, there's something else there than just the two of you. And the other component is there's something really possible. Human beings were born to be in relationships where, you know, we live in herds and groups and villages. So there's something else that's possible when you're truly in a relationship that is miraculous and marvelous. And most people come to see us trying to get out of pain. You know, we say, what would you like in your couple? They say, we want to stop arguing. We want to communicate. We want to stop hurting each other. And we're talking about getting from minus 5 or minus 6 to 0. We're talking about what's between 0 and 10.
Yeah.
What's a relationship where the power of the couple is really evident?
Well,
just finished writing our latest blog for Psychology Today is all about this, about when a couple takes on dealing with a challenge or a tragedy that's occurred in their lives or in their community, there's a lot more power and possibility and strength in them working together to make something happen. And we give several examples of how couples have done that. A homeopathic physician wanted to have a health center in India. It was his dream for many years. It never happened until he married and they created a joint vision for this health center. And now they have this fabulous place that people can go to get healed that wouldn't have happened without couple power.
Well, you guys are great salespeople for this. I seem to recall some negative research findings from some years ago, see if this rings a bell for you at all, that a study that seemed to suggest that that marriage therapy didn't seem to be that effective if the measure was divorce. In other words, that a pretty significant number of people who had gone to see marriage therapists ended up getting divorced.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could imagine that when you work with people, and we'll talk in a minute about what are the elements of creating this couple power, this entity that we call a couple. Sometimes we're not saying everybody in every relationship ought to be together or stay together. A lot of times we don't know much when we go in, and we learn things subsequently. But what we are able to say is, you know, the therapies that work on diagnosing the problems usually come up with lots of problems.
Yeah.
Therapies that look at possible inventing of things you hadn't even thought about before. You know, we're talking really about a paradigm shift in how we look at working with relationships. Not like, is there enough for you, Dave, in your relationship? Is there enough for you, Phyllis, in your relationship? It's like, what's your relationship? Who do you want your relationship to be like? What do you want it to be like so that together you can both get what you want? And that's a real difference in how we look at it. And a lot of Neil Jacobson, some of that early research I think you're referring to,
right,
in the late 90s, that said, you know, we might be doing more damage in couples therapy than not, was probably right on. But it had to do with the approach that people took.
Yes.
And the approach that we take that is different and that is partly based on the work of Neil Jacobson, who unfortunately passed away at a young age, is that you don't necessarily want to start with people communicating everything they feel and everything that they think is wrong.
Okay, we're going to come to some more about that in a bit. Now, you write about four types of couple personalities. Maybe you can take us through them.
Well, we think just from our experience, there are at least four ways that people present, kind of models, and there's nothing wrong with them. The issue is sometimes people get stuck in models. So the first model or the first kind of personality is what we call the romantic or the romanticized relationship, where people are very much in love with being in love and everything that's attendant to that. They love being together. They, you know, it's the kind of time in your relationship you might remember when you fall in love. It's like, this is great. I'm really in love with this person, but I got to get some sleep, you know, or I spent some time at work or something. I think when Phyllis and I were falling in love, I got mono. You know, I think I went to meet her parents. I was already completely physically exhausted. But the concentration is on the chemistry and the love and the physical intimacy, which is all very great. But for some people, when that begins to change, they abandon the relationship. And then they say, well, I'm not getting that from this person now. Now I need to find somebody else.
Mm-hmm. So that would relate to, quotes, falling out of love?
Yes, it could definitely relate to that.
You know, we're not definitely poo-pooing romance. You want to keep romance alive in your relationship. It's when you kind of get addicted to the romanticized part of the relationship that it can be a problem, and you don't have the flexibility to change and adapt as your life proceeds.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. What's the second type that you talk about?
The second type of relationship is one that we would call a traditional relationship, where there's sort of traditionally defined roles for each member of the couple. So one is the hostess with the mostess, or one is the big support, or one is the one who works while the other goes to school. And then there's a certain point in that relationship where that agreement might begin to fall apart. It's like, wait a minute, we decided I was going to put you through school, and then when you got settled, I was going to go back to school, and now that hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. So people get kind of caught in a particular role that they don't ever get to renegotiate. So it's sometimes years, decades down the road, people get angry and resentful that they never got to get the thing that they really wanted to have.
And for some couples, it may work fine, and that's great. We're not suggesting that people have to change. I said before, it's a designer marriage. You get to make it the way you want it. It's just that for a lot of people, like Peter was saying, if they don't deal with the resentment that's behind it, then it can start to really eat away at the relationship. The third one we call the self-focused couple. And that maybe is kind of the most prominent one of our age, where you have people in the individualistic culture focusing on themselves and losing sight of where couple is a part of their life and how couple can be supported and they can get support from the couple.
So you have dual career relationships, for instance, where everybody is working very hard, and then in addition to that, you may have family responsibilities, but what happens is you're so focused on what it is that you're trying to accomplish, there literally isn't enough time to be in a relationship, because you're so busy doing all of those other things. Hollywood relationships are often common, not just the star quality, but just the busyness factor of how is it that you actually get to spend time in and on your relationship when you're spending so much time doing something else.
And it's very difficult just for the normal family, especially with young children. A lot of the people we see who come in who are in trouble have worked out the logistics of their family okay, where they do a tag team kind of thing, taking care of the kids. But couple gets lost in the shuffle. They don't have any time set aside to be with each other or have fun with each other.
Yeah,
and they get focused on just managing themselves. Well, they may put the kids, but then themselves first and the couple is last.
Yeah, each of the three patterns that you've described so far seem, you know, very familiar there.
Yeah.
I think it's a good categorization scheme so far. What's the fourth one?
Well, the fourth one is more, you know, because you probably want to know, like, if these are some difficulties, is there some better way to do that or some ideal? And it's not really an ideal, but some form of relationship that has some flexibility to it, because each of the three things we mentioned has its merits, and couples do a lot of these things sometimes in order or as they get older. So the fourth type of relationship is what we call a co-creating relationship.
Or we also call it the dynamic couple, because it's constantly changing. That's what a dynamic is.
Yes.
So you're creating together. The co-creating couple is a dynamic couple. You're creating together what your life is going to look like from day to day.
Okay.
So Phyllis wants to vacation at the ocean. I want to be in the mountains. What a co-creating couple would do is look for a third thing. You know, or a friend of mine once said, are you a glass half empty or a glass half full person? They said, I'm a let's get a different glass person.
Okay. You seem to like the number four because you also talk about the four C's of building lifelong love: commitment, cooperation, communication, and community. Maybe we can step through these. The first one's commitment. Commitment to what?
Commitment is the basis. It's the foundation for everything else you're going to do in your couple. If you start trying to communicate or even cooperate in a project together before you've got a commitment to some vision that you're jointly committed to, you're going to be on working on thin ice.
Yeah.
So commitment is always the first part, and it's commitment to the relationship, commitment to the vision for that relationship.
Because we're really talking about couple as an entity, you know, in and of itself. So you're committed to the success of that entity. And when you are able to be committed, the question is, like, what does that look like? If we're going on a trip, where are we actually going? So we work with couples in inventing and creating those statements of their commitment. You know, you get married, you have vows, that's a statement of commitment. Most people never revisit those vows or say them again, or they may not even experience them as being alive. For us, what's important is the commitment is alive in the moment, and that has, you know, has to do with having that vision in front of you. If you're
the
like,
way we do that is through a technique we call creating a couple proclamation. So just like the Emancipation Proclamation states what the vision for all men being created equal is, we have each couple create, actually every few months, to update a couple proclamation of what they're up to. So we've been doing this for probably 25 years. We've had probably now hundreds of couple proclamations. And, for example, the one we have now is, let us say, and we
usually say them together.
You yourselves in your relationship have had hundreds?
Hundreds.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
hundreds.
Interesting.
So the one we're doing now is
we treasure our pleasure.
And that helps by saying it every day and taking a stock at the end of the day what our pleasures were for that day. Keeps us on track of, you know, really keeping that vision in place.
And it's not always so serious. You know, we've had proclamations like, we are cute, you know, or we're on fire, or, you know, we're a powerful couple, or something like that.
Hmm.
And we say it literally, we say it every day, almost like an affirmation to remind us that we're a couple, and that's when we just don't say it when we're feeling good. We often it when we're not. That's when that really comes to hand.
Couples often say, well, but I don't feel like it now, or I don't believe it. I said, well, that's okay. Just fake it till you make it.
So now I'm picturing the two of you gritting your teeth, being angry about something and saying, we are cute.
And in our book, in Lifelong Love, we have lots of examples in our life and in the people we've worked with, you know, who talk about exactly that sort of thing. It's like, this is the last time in the world you would expect that to be there. But just by speaking it, putting it in language, it makes something possible. So that's C number one.
Yeah. I'm very interested in this. You know, I've worked on corporate kinds of visioning projects. You know,
very similar to a mission statement.
Yeah. How did you guys come up with this anyway?
Well, we've been developing these concepts for a long time, and we started working together with a group of people who actually, we'll talk about it more when we get to community, have developed a community called Couples Coaching Couples. And in developing the distinctions for this organization, we started to see that we need to declare what we're up to.
Mm-hmm.
And so the genesis of the couple proclamation is very similar to what Couples Coaching Couples talks about as a declaration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
we have had some business consulting experience. You know, we've worked in academic departments, counseling centers, you know, groups where this kind of creation has been extremely powerful.
Yes.
So I think it's really kind of developed over a long, long, long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like it.
Yeah, and then it helps because we know as therapists, and most people who are therapists know, if people aren't really committed to something, there's no sense seeing them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, if do you want to, and we ask that question, so are you committed to your into this relationship? And the answer is yes, no, or maybe. And if it's no for either of you, then we really don't need to go any further. You know, if it's yes, we're, you know, we will proceed. And if it's, even if it's maybe, it's like, okay, let's proceed. And then we begin to proceed to the second C from the first C of commitment.
Yeah, let's go to the second C, which is cooperation. And cooperation seems so obvious on the face of it, but it's not necessarily easy to achieve. So what's the secret to developing cooperation?
Well, one of the secrets is getting that cooperation is distinct from compromise. Compromise, somebody is always having to give something up in order to get something. Mm-hmm. In cooperating, you work together as a team for a joint goal, keeping on going until everyone's needs are met and the goal is met by the couple working together. And, for example, Peter was saying, you know, as long as you're willing to commit to something, this young man who was not willing to commit to marriage was willing to commit to a 2-month process of working on their sexual relationship through sex therapy. And he was very clear that he was willing to do that, and she was willing as well. So they're going to cooperate to work on their sexual relationship in a way that meets both of their needs. And they're going to be a team about it. So cooperation, a lot of people, like you said, it seems obvious. They think they cooperate well, but they probably are not. They're probably either compromising or demanding and not making the kind of requests and agreements that keep a cooperation working well.
Yeah, Dave, you said it. We think we're pretty good at cooperating. If you ask me, I'm great at it. It's just the people around me aren't so good.
Yeah.
And that's because they don't do what I ask them
uh-huh.
to do.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about cooperation, you know, the notion obviously is like having a team. You know, you write national championship on the blackboard in the locker room on the first day, and then you support each other in doing that. It creates the possibility of some diversity. See, one of the issues we hear a lot about is, like, I'm incompatible with my partner. She's an extrovert, I'm an introvert, she's intellectualized, and I'm feeling, and blah, blah. And usually we see that as something that divides us. In the context of team, it actually gives you versatility. It gives you diversity. Phyllis is the extrovert in our relationship. I'm more of an introvert. Well, between the two of us, we get to go to a lot of parties because Phyllis arranges that. And yet I'm the one who does the packing for the camping trips because I'm the one who remembers everything because we're very, very different. So now, all of a sudden, one of the obstacles becomes one of the strengths of your relationship.
Yes, yes. Now, the third step is communication. And we've all heard that communication is important and that couples need to work on communication. And a lot of the books and so on seem to be organized around you need better communication. But you suggest certain kinds of communication are helpful at certain times, but not so helpful at others. And Phyllis, you started to say something about that
right,
earlier.
It's important that communication be the third C. If you start that at that place, that's what the research shows, is that people will actually sometimes make things worse by telling each other everything that they think is wrong with the other person.
Uh-huh.
And it convinces them that they shouldn't be together. So you want to keep communication on hold until you've gotten commitment and cooperation clear. I've even sometimes given people the homework of stop communicating.
Well, dear, now that I feel completely free to say what's on my mind, I can finally tell you that I found you revolting and disgusting for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Is not a good place to start.
Right. You know?
But if there's a grounding of commitment and now a little bit of a capacity to cooperate, now communication is really important because you want to be clear when you're asking for things or giving things what exactly is going on.
Yeah.
Well, and it's still the communication is in service of the joint goal. And each person, we like to say, out of cooperation, is 100%, 100% responsible. You don't spend time figuring out which 50-50, you know, part of that you're responsible for. Both of you take on full responsibility for the communication and for what happens in the relationship. So if you don't like the kind of communication you're getting from your partner, you take on equal responsibility to correcting that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It certainly fits with, you know, with some other ideas that are out there that I've been exposed to. Now, the fourth step you describe is community. And if there's anything that describes contemporary life, it might be the loss of community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what community are you talking about here?
We remembered from our days in inpatient treatment when we would work with people who would make fantastic gains in therapy and in treatment, and we would send them out into the world and they would be back in a couple of days because there was no space in the world for them to use the new skills they've learned. And for a lot of people, this is true about how the world is about being in a relationship. It's not very relationship friendly. So part of what we've begun to look at is where are the communities that you can go into that really respect family, that respect couple, that respect cooperation and aren't just into individuality. And so there, you know, there are two kinds of community. At least there's the vertical kind, the kind you have with your parents and grandparents and children and maybe grandchildren, where you help each other, support each other, and work with each other to support being in a relationship. And then there's the kind of horizontal community, people, your peers, your siblings, where you actually are in community. And it's in that area we have found most of community is lacking, that people come to us, they say, wow, we've had a breakthrough in our, breaking up what's been going on in our old ways, and now we're into some new ways, but nobody we know understands that. So we actually encourage them to find or create communities, like we'll have an assignment say, go make friends with another couple, not mm-hmm. an individual with a spouse, but actually another couple.
Well, and even when they do have couples that they're friends with, I have a couple I've been working with for a while now who's about ready to complete, go out in the world, and they said that they've started telling these couples what it is they've been doing and what impact it's had on them. So rather than just getting together and shooting the breeze, they're actually now able to talk about issues that really make a difference for them and to support the other couples as well. So mm-hmm. if you don't have that kind of thing in your life, like Peter was saying, it's likely that you could, you know, it's a slippery slope. And we talked about, you know, maintaining the relationship, maintaining lifelong love. That's the real challenge of our age.
So find people, find communities. They may be religious communities. You're in a church or a synagogue or
yeah.
a mosque. It may be, you know, a neighborhood group that you're with where you can actually interact as people in relationships, talk about that, be with it, and it can be an immense amount of fun. We do, and when we treat couples, sometimes the follow-up treatment for them is to put them in groups with other couples where they can create a community. And then the third thing that we've done is, as Phyllis had mentioned before, to create this national nonprofit organization called Couples Coaching Couples, which are people from all around the country who take time and spend a little time supporting one another and coaching each other in their relationship.
And each city has one or more what we call circles or groups of couples who get together every few months to report what they've been doing in what we call the quartets of two couples coaching each other. And then every few months we switch who you're going to be coaching with, and you get a fresh start on creating and recreating your couple newly. And once a year we have a national convention,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I'm assuming that there would be information on your website.
Yes.
It's on our website, couplepower.com, and there's also a couplescoachingcouples.org website.
Okay, good. And, you know, you were talking about the religious connection, the role that the church has served, I think, maybe more so in the past than these days, or at least more people were involved. I had some friends years ago who were involved in workshops that sounds a little similar to what you're doing. I seem to recall it was called Marriage Encounter.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it was sponsored by a Catholic organization. You sound like you're familiar with that. Do you
yeah.
have any opinions about
well,
that?
Well, we think it's a very powerful program and a powerful start. The difficulty that some people may have is in really creating an ongoing participation. the thing about couples coaching, couples is something you can do on the telephone
weekly
for 30 to 40 minutes, and that it continues to be, actually becomes part of your life. It's sort of like brushing your teeth. You know, you wouldn't say, I just go from dentist appointment to dentist appointment without anything in between.
Yeah.
So for this, it's like, what's the maintenance? How do you get present regularly to the beauty of your own relationship and the power you have together? So I think there are a lot of really good programs for people in relationships, but it's the follow-up. And for us, it's not even the follow-up. It's the ongoing relationship mm-hmm. to what it is that you've invented.
And it's not affiliated with any religious context.
Mm-hmm.
It has a moral base, but it doesn't have that religious connection.
Yeah,
and,
which would be a turnoff for some people.
And also you have that creating of a community in each city where you're involved in the coaching.
Yeah.
Because it's not just the quartet, it's the community of quartets that mm-hmm. is so powerful.
How long has that program been going on?
We had our 20-year anniversary two years ago.
Right, 1991, I think that program started.
Yeah, good for you.
Been around for a while.
You go on to talk about a fifth C. What's the fifth C?
Yes, we like to say once you've got the four C's handled, then you are able to have couple consciousness, which is what we call the fifth C of couple power or lifelong love. And that is being able to look at the world through this filter of couple, through the lens of couple. So when there are difficult decisions to make, you have the filter of couple and what you're up to in the world to guide you. And it makes a lot of the decisions easier. It may also, as I said, like with my art exhibit, it gives us a way to support each other by relying on our couple to give us the extra juice that we need to keep things alive and viable in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, I can see where this approach could be very helpful for young couples just starting out with a really positive vision, getting off on the right foot. But what about couples that have been together for quite a few years, perhaps, and they already have a lot of bad history under the bridge?
Well, the nice thing about this, and we see a lot of older couples, is that once you create this couple proclamation, you have a whole new place to come from. So it makes it easier to deal with all the garbage from the past because you're not wedded to that and tied to it. You're moving in a new direction.
Yeah, as Peter pointed out in the beginning, people tend to come to therapy because they're in pain. So I'm guessing that probably it's not so much newlyweds that you're seeing, but people who are in pain maybe after being married for some time.
Yeah, usually.
Or sometimes they're just numb, you know, and then something mm-hmm. happens, someone gets ill or some way. You know, retirement is one of these things that happens as we go through the baby boomer generation where we have people who are now retiring and living 15, 20, 30 more years in their relationship. It requires some flexibility. It requires some rethinking. And a lot of people come in because they just feel like they don't have the resources to manage it when, in fact, they do. They're just not in touch with us.
Okay. Well, one challenging problem for marriages, I have an upcoming interview on infidelity, which is probably one of the biggest challenges of all to a relationship. What success have you seen with that issue using your approach?
Well, we've had quite a bit of success. Again, if we can get the couple to a place where they see the value of the relationship as an entity and committing to the vision for that, then they work together on whatever they need to do to get complete about the affair or the relationships that they had or one of them had in the past. I have a couple I just saw for a few sessions where that happened. And the wife was about ready to call it quits, but once he got clear that he was committed to this relationship and was able to communicate that clearly, then they could work together on how they were going to make sure that the trust was built up again.
Now, we certainly don't work with people who are unwilling to give up that infidelity, you know, on an ongoing basis. But there's always, the future doesn't always have to look like the past. So there's always things to learn from whatever failures or whatever circumstances has happened. So we encourage people to look at that part of it rather than to dwell in what the past was. I think we've all of us who work with couples have had experiences that some people never recover from infidelity. Some people will recover from it just fine. So you do have some choice in the matter, and it often has to do with the reestablishment of trust. And that's really very, very difficult to say, how do you reestablish trust? And part of it is, it's a leap of faith. And what Phyllis is saying is, once you can recreate or create your commitment and to a particular vision, then that it's a vision that you can trust and commit to that.
You two met in a research program, and I'm wondering to what extent has your approach, as it's evolved, been influenced by research or by other psychological theorists? Are there any?
Well, we've certainly been influenced by the family systems folks, you know, Virginia Satir and people at the Mental Research Institute. We've also, you know, done some research. We're in the middle of a research project now, which your listeners can also participate in. I don't know, can I give the website for that?
Definitely.
For that research. So we have a study where we're looking at the four C's and marital satisfaction, and it's at www.surveymonkey.com/S/RPRP, which is the Relationship Possibilities Research Project. So it's surveymonkey.com/S/RPRP. So we are involved in and have done some research in looking at the impact of the four C's and shown that it does correlate with marital satisfaction. And we're also looking at evaluating the program that we're doing. But we've based a lot of our work on Neil Jacobson's early work, and you know, we're also very aware of the work of John Gottman and Sue Johnson, who are really looking at kind of what are the factors that impact people's relationship. We like to think we're looking not so much at what's wrong all the time, but as what's new and what can be created.
Mm-hmm. And have there been any critics of your approach?
One of the blogs that we wrote on Psychology Today was asked the question, do you really want lifelong singlehood? And this was based on some survey research that had come out about how many people were now choosing to stay single for their life. And we really meant to put it out there just as a question, and, you know, to be clear that what people's choices were. And there, we got a lot of, you know, sort of backlash from that. that people might think that we're saying that choosing being single, you know, isn't a viable choice. It is, if that's what you want. But as Peter was saying, so many people give up the idea or desire for being in a couple without having had the advantage of finding, you know, the kinds of things we're talking about as ways to maintain a relationship. So, you know, there was some backlash in that regard, but I hope that we cleared that up and people understand that, you know, we're not denigrating their choice, but we want to give people every advantage.
And any time you challenge an existing paradigm, there's going to be a lot of controversy about it. So, that, you know, that's a good sign for us that we're asking people to think about things a little bit differently, and so they are noticing that.
Okay, well, I think we've covered the ground that I had hoped to. Are there any final thoughts that you'd like to get in here before we close off?
Well, we just encourage people, you know, to see their relationships in a different way, to come at it through, you know, this possibility. We are certainly available. We do workshops to train therapists. We do workshops for couples. That information is available on our website, couplepower.com.
And we've been doing recently what we call intensives, where a couple may come in for a weekend, and it's remarkable how their relationship can be, you know, they can clear obstacles and they can get clear about a proclamation and move forward in just working several hours for a couple of days and then with some follow-up there. So there are many ways that you can access turning around, you know, patterns that have not worked for you, either, you know, like you say, for if you've been married a short period of time or a long period of time. There's always possibility if you're willing to put yourself out there. And, you know, sometimes it's enough to, you know, we wrote this book, Lifelong Love, so that it would have people all over the world would have access to these ideas and these exercises. And hopefully people will take advantage of that and not just give up before they've tried.
Well, that's a final message there of real hope. I think just about everybody longs for a lifelong love, and for many it's kind of an elusive goal. And so you've given us hope and a sense of direction. So Phyllis Scott Sherris and Peter Sherris, I want to thank you two for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
I don't know about you, if you're married, but I experienced the sort of medical student syndrome in which I could recognize myself in each of the marriage personality scenarios that Phyllis and Peter described. Especially strong for me in the early years was the first one that they described as being in love with love. Before I was married, as a young man, I was in love with being in love. I was really hooked on the thrill of infatuation. It was a real psychic shock for me when I fell out of love with a young woman who loved me as completely as I had ever wished. I went through a period of real disillusionment. I had assumed that once I was in love, and that that love was completely returned by the beautiful woman who was the object of my love, that it would last forever. I just had not been adequately prepared, I guess, for the existential reality that the initial intensity of romantic love fades over time. And I felt that somehow it was my failing. Personally, I was both ill-equipped and poorly programmed by family and by society for the sort of marriage that Peter and Phyllis champion and exemplify. As in some of the examples they gave, I grew up in a context of only troubled, unhappy marriages. I had no examples of the sorts of marriage that my guests were talking about. Also, as a young man, I was steeped in lots of novels and movies in which the hero was always depicted as a restless rebel and not a guy who was particularly devoted to home and family, to mowing the lawn and raising babies and so on. So as you might guess, there have been some bumps in the road along the way. But here I am, still married to a good woman, with 4 very fine grown children and 4 young grandchildren. By the way, when Peter and Phyllis mentioned their marriage intensives, it brought to mind the delightful movie Hope Springs with Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones. I had difficulty retrieving that memory quickly enough to bring it up in the interview. If you haven't seen that film, I highly recommend it. It's a delightful take on the sorts of issues that we were discussing in this interview. I'm impressed by the positive framing that Peter and Phyllis bring to the marital adventure. I think their book will be a fine resource for anyone who is about to embark on the marital path or who is dealing with difficulties in their couple relationship. In fact, I think this would be a wonderful book for husband and wife to read out loud together. If you decide to get the book, I hope you will remember to use our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio site.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Gloria Ullman from Adelaide in South Australia, and I've been listening to all the wonderful people asking for support for Shrink Wrap Radio on your behalf for financial donations, and I thought I'd put in one for support of another kind. And that is in doing transcriptions. I had been hearing for years you asking for people to volunteer to do transcriptions, but hadn't really felt pulled to do one until one day I was writing up so many notes on a Tom Elsner interview because it didn't have a transcription that I decided to offer to do one. And I've done several now. And it's been a very worthwhile exercise. In the process of transcribing, I have to listen so very intensely that it really helps to deepen my understanding of what is being talked about in the interviews, and it's been a very, very rich experience. It's one of those things that you have to do it to realize yourself, but I have actually had lots of synchronicities occurring through the process of when I'm doing a transcription. And also several dreams have come out of when I've been working that intensely on the material within a particular interview. It has unexpected rewards. So I'm encouraging anybody who has thought about it to give it a go. It is time consuming. I'm not a very fast typist. And sometimes I have to stop and look up different terminology that's used or references to names and things like that. So it can be time consuming in that way. But again, very rewarding. And also, I think it is a good service. I know that I have taken advantage of having the transcriptions available. Having a transcript is very useful if I want to quickly scan an interview before listening to it. And it's also good to have a reference if I want to check back on something. And I think particularly for students or even professionals who want to have a reference, it's also a good idea to have a transcription available. So give it a go if you feel inclined and enjoy the exercise.
Thanks once again for this call to action, Gloria. And if any of you wish to respond by volunteering to transcribe an episode, just drop me a line for instructions on how to proceed. Meanwhile, speaking of Gloria and transcriptions, she's done yet another one, which is episode number 292, The Mother Line, with Jungian analyst Naomi Ruth Lewinsky. Gloria let me know that this one took a bit longer than usual because she was so touched by the content. Indeed, when people do a transcript, they often find that they are listening to the content more closely, and sometimes that can also have the effect of triggering more insights and feelings related to their own personal issues. I was contacted by Tom, a new listener in New York, and Shrink Wrap Radio had been recommended to him by a psychotherapist friend, but he was having a devil of a time figuring out how to download episodes to his desktop for later transfer onto his MP3 player. His confusion and frustration was certainly understandable to me. On shrinkwrapradio.com, there is an MP3 player at the bottom of each episode, and if you want to download it rather than listen right away, there's a button or a word there that says download. Well, guess what? To Tom's consternation, clicking on the word download just plays it in another window rather than actually downloading the file. The trick is, if you're on a Windows machine, as Tom was, you have to right-click on the word download, which will then pop up a menu of options. And the choice you want to select is Save Link As, and then tell it to save it to a folder on your computer or onto your computer desktop. From there, you'll be able to drag the newly downloaded file onto your MP3 player. Now, on a Mac, you would control-click on the word download, unless you've already programmed your mouse to know that right-clicking is the same as control-clicking. Now, many of you know this already somehow. It's kind of the lore of of downloading files on the Internet, I guess. It certainly is misleading that download doesn't actually download without a right-click, and there's nothing obvious about that. I don't know if that's an artifact of web browsers in general or WordPress, which I use to create these episodes, but it is one of those little non-obvious annoyances. I don't think there is any way to change it on my end. If there is a listener out there more technical than I am, feel free to contact me with ideas for rectifying that. Speaking of ways to listen to Shrink Wrap Radio, we do have an app for both iOS and Android devices. Just click on the Apps tab on our site for full details. If you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that if you're also a professional in need of continuing education units, that we have about 99 APA-approved units that you can earn for listening to these interviews and passing a brief true-false quiz on the material, all for less than $10 a unit.
Hi, this is Dr. Jonathan Katz, Chicago-based clinical psychologist, martial artist, and creativity workshop leader, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
And if you're guessing that Dr. Jonathan Katz will be my next guest, then you'd be right. But first, let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from new listener Lola, who sent me the following on Facebook. Hi, Dr. Dave. Hola from Valencia, Spain, or Valencia, Spain. You've just friended me. Thanks. I love your podcast and love listening and re-listening to your conversations with such interesting guests. As I am a fairly new member of your audience, I am playing catch-up, and last night I listened to the Dr. John Jackson episode. I learned a little bit about archetypes 20 years ago in high school, and am finding myself drawn to this idea once more. Your show is for experts and non-experts alike, with something for everyone, as well as being uber practical and applicable to life. Thanks again. Well, thank you, Lola. It's so wonderful always to get a new listener. And sometimes people will communicate with me through a direct message, I guess it is, on Facebook. I'm not totally conversant in Facebook, but it's really thrilling to hear from a listener in Valencia, because when I was around 19 or 20 or 21, I spent 4 weeks in Valencia, Spain. I'd gone to Europe with my girlfriend of the time, and she went off to France to study French, and I went to Spain, to Valencia, to study, to hopefully get better in Spanish, and maybe to pick up some flamenco guitar. And I was living in a pension initially, and then I met a waiter in a bar who I developed a friendship with, and he invited me to come and live with his family. I could pay him less than I was paying the pension, he suggested, and so we would both make out. So I did that, which was a wonderful experience. I really regret that I lost touch with them over the years. As a 19-year-old, I was not a very faithful correspondent, I must say. But no one in that family spoke English. We were in a small apartment with him, his wife, their daughter, his sister-in-law and brother-in-law, and their one or two children. And I had a little room to myself. So I was getting a crash course in Spanish, which was good because I was not doing well back at my University of Pennsylvania, where I'd been taking Spanish, and I think I had about a D going and was in danger of failing. So after my 4-week intensive in Valencia, didn't take any classes, but living with his family and just chatting with people as I walked about, I was able to raise my grade. So I have very fond memories of Valencia and of my time in Spain. And I guess I've been back to Spain. I don't think of it as Spain. I've been to Mallorca to do workshops with my friend Ron Alexander, and I think I went to Mallorca with him twice, two or three times, I think maybe twice. And that is Spain, I guess. I just, to me, it's an island, and it's different. But I've wandered away from Lola again. Thank you. Glad to have you as a new listener. Next, we hear from Vinny, who writes, Hi, David. I have an idea for some people for you to interview. They are Joe Griffin and Ivan Tyrell, or it might be Yvonne Tyrell. Their website is www.hgi.org.uk. Now, I went to that URL, and HGI stands for Human Givens Institute. So they have their own approach to therapy, revolving around their concept of the human givens. And so you all can go visit that site. I've not heard of the approach before. You can check it out, see if you're interested. And I'm adding that to my long list of suggested guests. Vinny goes on to write, I was suffering from chronic anxiety and was in a private psychiatric facility getting the best of care, but not getting any better. I had read their book, Human Givens, but had not pursued it any further. In desperation, I found a trained practitioner in the technique near the hospital. I went and did the rewind technique. That must be one of their techniques. You will have to read the book to find out what that is. Amazingly, my anxiety eased after a couple of days. Also, after a few days, feelings relating to a trauma I suffered as a child started to come up. A few more rewinds and 3 months of intense psychotherapy later, I'm much better and have hope for a better future. I would love to hear you interviewing them. Regards, Vinny. Vinny, I'm so happy to hear about the positive results and success that you have had as a result of working with them. And it sounds like an excellent suggestion, so I've definitely added it to my list. And you keep listening and communicating with us as well. And finally, we hear the following from Wendy in response to my recent interview with Dr. Danielle Shapook, Miss Wheelchair New York City. And Wendy writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, I love your show and listen every week." Hey, that's music to my ears. She goes on to say, "Thanks for all that you do. I wanted to pass on one of those lovely synchronistic experiences that happen from time to time. Last weekend, I was visiting Boulder, Colorado, due to being evacuated from our home near Colorado Springs because of massive wildfire." That's another story, she writes. She goes on to say, "I discovered a Shakespeare festival at the University of Colorado, and I took my young children to see A Midsummer Night's Dream. The female character, Hermina, has the male characters fighting over her. She has a strong and sexy presence. Also, in this version, she's disabled. I was pleased to see a woman with physical challenges presented as desirable and empowered, as I too have a disability. My kids are growing up in a world that is changing quickly. I'm inspired to see the world becoming more inclusive. The interview with Dr. Danielle Shapook was also quite inspiring. I hope her pilot makes it on air, and I hope you can pass on the Boulder Shakespeare Festival's contribution to her mission. All the best." And that's from Wendy McGee in Monument, Colorado. And Wendy, thanks for sharing that synchronicity, and I'm really glad to hear some feedback about that interview with Danielle. Yours is the first that I've received. And I did pass on your email to Dr. Shapook, so she will get the word that her message took hold with you, and she'll know about the strides that theater group in Colorado has made. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to me to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to husband and wife team Peter Sherris and Phyllis Koch Sherris for sharing their insights and experience on creating lifelong love. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Jonathan Katz, a clinical psychologist who works from a Jungian and mind-body perspective. He specializes in working with people to enhance creativity and performance, as well as integrating movement and meditation practices from traditional Chinese martial arts, meditation, and qigong. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.